You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Are we going to start treating all Muslim Americans differently? Are we going to start discriminating against them because of their faith? We've heard these suggestions during the course of this campaign. Do Republican officials actually agree with this? Because that's not the America we want.
US President Barack Obama attacks Donald Trump over his response to last weekend's tragic events in Orlando. We'll discuss the fallout. Then, Turkey is set to miss a deadline regarding its membership of the European Union. And the United Nations faces fresh accusations it's breaching its principles in the Syrian conflict. Plus...
You did nothing! You did nothing! You're lying! You're a fraud! You did nothing to help these people! God bless them!
Bizarre face-off between two camps in the EU referendum battle in London on the River Thames. We'll explain more. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome to you both. The US is still trying to process the tragic events that took place in Orlando last weekend, in which 49 people were shot dead and many more injured at a gay nightclub. The killer had claimed allegiance to ISIS, but as we've learnt more about him, the more complicated his beliefs have become. Investigators are currently probing how much the gunman's wife knew before the attack. Before we hear from Rosemary and Mary, let's head over to Orlando, where Monocle's Thomas Lewis is standing by. Thomas, welcome to Midori House. Can you bring us up to date with what's been happening so far today?
Yes, so we are expecting in about half an hour, Steve, a press conference by the FBI and Orlando Police. We are not quite sure the contents of that statement yet, but we are expecting probably some more information on the reports that were swirling around yesterday, as you touched upon in your introduction, about the gunman's wife and what she knew and what she didn't know about the atrocities in the early hours of Sunday morning. On a national scale, I'd say it feels here that the, you know, political football match, if you like, has begun in earnest today. Donald Trump has just begun speaking at a campaign event in Atlanta. He didn't begin by talking about the atrocities, but he did go into that fairly swiftly after making a rather offbeat point about how the media had been covering it. We're also seeing Democratic politicians have taken to the floor a short while ago to try and to begin a filibuster to try and close one of the major loopholes in current gun legislation in the United States. I would say, though, briefly here on the ground, I think this tragedy has touched so many areas, if you like, from the Muslim community to the LGBT community to even the gun rights activists on both sides of the debate. So, as you said, Steve, it is a confusing picture, and it's still rather confusing still for many people here in Orlando to try and pick through kind of what the latest is, I think.
Tom Lewis in Orlando, thank you very much indeed. And you can hear more from Tom on the Monocle Daily. That's tonight at 2200 London hours, 1700 if you're listening in New York City. Rosemary, Donald Trump's comments earlier this week, and again, as Tom says, he's speaking again now, about essentially painting all Muslims in America as potentially dangerous. Were, as Barack Obama said yesterday, really sort of taking America down a very dark road, weren't they?
Absolutely, but I think there's amazement that when you have the full weight of the President of the United States lambasting or trying to put a presidential candidate in their place for most inappropriate, broad brush language, offensive, and so unpresidential, and yet he aspires to be the president, and it seems not to matter at all to Donald Trump. He seems to thrive on this stuff. And I think Maybe we can do this later in the programme, I don't know. But I see a parallel with the debate going on in Britain right now about Brexit. The kind of astonishment of a traditional political elite that this can happen in an election campaign, that the kind of language being used is being used by Donald Trump and he gets away with it, and that the mud that he slings sticks. It's a bit like claims by both camps, but I'm more struck by the Brexit camp, making claims that don't stand up to scrutiny. And yet, because they've thrown it out there, people who want to believe what they're saying do.
Mary, on the point of Donald Trump, I mean, in some ways, we shouldn't be surprised. This is a man who started his entire campaign for US president by using the phrase, Mexicans are rapists. This is a man who has never been at all careful when it comes to language in saying, well, the vast majority of Group X is fine, but there's a small minority we should be worried about.
Yes. I mean, I think that I agree with Rosemary. I mean, almost nothing has stuck to Donald Trump. But I would say, as it were, almost as a preface, that I thought the your correspondence report was very interesting and very refreshing, because it was so unlike so many reports, whether from over here or from over there, that really use incredibly florid language and all sorts of, you know, distinct categories. And he was speaking in really quite nuanced terms and saying, look, this is a very confused picture. There's a lot of things going on here. And I think there are a lot of things going on. But the idea that because Donald Trump immediately claimed vindication and said, you know, I always said that Muslims were a bad idea and should be barred from the US, and here I am, I'm right. He was immediately attacked for that. But the problem is that I think that there is sufficient that is almost right in what he said, in that the perpetrator was a Muslim. That he's going to get away with it. And there was a lot of talk...
Which is not the same as almost right, if you see what...
No, but immediately after...
I see what you're saying.
Yes.
But this is the phenomenon we're up against.
Yes, but immediately afterwards, the whole sort of focus shifted so that this was, as it were, an anti-gay crime rather than a crime by a Muslim. And Trump has sort of stood his ground on this. And he's taken this rebuff, I mean, this enormous criticism, as Rosemary said, from the incumbent president. You know, this doesn't happen every day, that a president turns up in the White House briefing room and lambasts a candidate. But frankly, I don't think it's going to do Trump the sort of harm that either Obama or the Hillary Clinton camp expect, because there is enough in his version that for his camp will justify him.
Rosemary, on that point, as Mary says there, it's, you know, if you're not involved in US politics, it might sound a bit strange that, well, you know, Barack Obama is from one party, of course he's going to attack the candidate from the other. But in America, this really doesn't happen, does it? I was reading today that, well, the last instances was back in 2000 when, well, Bill Clinton said some mildly, you know, rude things about George W. Bush, basically suggesting that he was a rich guy who didn't really know much. And that was seen as, you know, really bad, and Bill Clinton shouldn't do that because it's the office of the president and you shouldn't say that. But again, you know, Mary's point, is this going to make a difference? He's even had other Republicans saying,
okay,
well, no, this is bad, but, you know, yet here we are.
Not to neglect the one point about the more we discover concerning the perpetrator of the awful attacks in Orlando, the more it reinforces the idea that with every terrorist outrage, it's important to take a whole range of factors into account to understand. And clearly, this man, by virtue of the fact that he was a regular visitor to the gay nightclub, it seems that his second wife actually delivered him there sometimes. I hypothesized, was he telling her that he was scoping it out for a potential action? How was he portraying to her? Why he would want to go to a gay nightclub, and so on. And it makes me recollect the puzzlement of some people in Britain when there has been homegrown terrorist action, and it's discovered that the youngsters concerned, or the young people in their 20s concerned, have actually had a what seems to be a normal schooling, but they had family troubles at home, or they didn't get on with their father, that they may have drunk to excess or taken drugs, tried the high life, and then were on a personal quest of repentance and wanting to be born again, and so on. All of this has to be taken into account if one wants to understand how someone might flip like that, at that level, in that way. And what we're seeing from Donald Trump is a refusal to pay any attention to anything as complex as that for pure political purposes. And I think someone as sophisticated, a trained lawyer, a constitutional lawyer, who's dealt with race issues and yet triumphed to get himself elected as president of the United States, must be in a state of disbelief that this can be happening.
I think there's probably an idea at the outset. I mean, how could something like this not affect the presidential campaign at this stage? And I think there was probably an idea, especially maybe on this side of the Atlantic, that how could it not help Hillary's campaign? On the one hand, there was the gun issue, and she's been quite tough on the gun issue. On the other hand, she's been very liberal in her social attitudes. Anti-gay crime would, as it were, play in a way to her strengths, and she's not Donald Trump on the Muslim question. So all that looked absolutely fine. But actually it's not fine, because on all those issues there is a constituency in America, it's the Trump constituency, that will come together actually to oppose her. Those are not particularly popular platforms in parts of the US.
Rosemary, is there, and we will come on to Brexit towards the end of the programme, in a sense this is a combination of two trends. There's the fear of the outsider and the sod you all element of, I'm not listening to any sort of politicians or elites or experts. It's those two things coming together in a quite poisonous way.
Well, I personally think now I begin to understand how populist dictators get elected in democracies. This is what it feels like. There's a disenfranchised, disillusioned, and very probably white North American or English constituency that is getting left behind by all the trends, and they are perfect audiences for people who appeal to their fears of any and of every other race-wise, religion-wise, or indeed class-wise. And so even if somebody from a relatively elite status, class-wise, is the one feeding them this stuff, in that sense, they're sort of cannon fodder, actually. You stir up the mob.
Mary, do you agree with that?
I mean, I don't completely agree, because I think that Trump is more sophisticated than that. And I'm not convinced, first of all, that he's not electable, but that also during the campaign, he's not going to show a different side where he won't actually come out looking as the very simplistic demagogue that he looks from some perspectives at the moment. I'm not saying that I had a vote, I'd vote for Trump. But I am saying that I think there is a constituency in America that he answers to, and that they do need representing, and also that the methods that he uses doesn't necessarily reflect how he would behave in office. I think there's a long, long way to go between where we are now and November the 8th.
Wow.
Is that quite an optimistic way of looking at it, by saying, well, look, it's, just because he said these things doesn't mean he'll actually act like that when he gets into power?
Yes, it's an optimistic thing. It's a, you can call it naive, you can call it Pollyanna-ish in the sense of hoping for the best. And of course, between now and then, there's a load of things that can happen. I mean, there are scandals that may attach to him. I mean, not releasing his tax returns is the first of these. That would play extremely badly in America if that continues. So, I I don't think it's not plain sailing. But I'm also not convinced that how he looks at the moment would how he would actually be as president.
OK, let's move on. The United Nations has today faced strong accusations of breaching its principles in the Syrian conflict. More than 50 humanitarian, human rights and civil society groups have backed a report that says that the UN has let the Syrian government dictate how aid is distributed. Rosemary, this is fair to accuse the UN of this, isn't it? It's the UN
it
talked
is,
about having aid drops, and then the Syrian government said we'd rather you didn't, and they didn't.
It seems that this dates from the beginning of the war in Syria, and it's depressing, but it's an echo of what we heard from Ban Ki-moon when he was confessing that in one of the most difficult moments in his career as Secretary General of the UN, he'd had to concede to the Saudis that they had to come be reinstated on the human rights body that they had been ousted from, because if they weren't reinstated, if their reputation wasn't whitewashed, they would withdraw their funding. And so he had to make one of these horrible utilitarian calculations. Do we save more people by having the Saudi money from poverty and other deprivation than if we stand by our principles? And in the Syrian case, if the Syrian government had refused to cooperate with the UN over any aid corridors, over any aid supplies to starving people, they couldn't have got anything in. Because under international law, that's how they have to operate. They can't, the UN Secretariat and all the aid agencies can't declare war on the Syrian government and fight their way in. So they are beholden to the host government. And the UN, it reminds us, is only the sum of its parts in many respects.
And Mary, there's also the other aspect, isn't there, that, you know, the UN and aid agencies generally have to deal with the organisation that owns, that rules the land, whether that is Al-Shabaab in parts of southern Somalia if there's a famine, whether that is the Taliban in parts of Afghanistan where there's a humanitarian need. You know, aid agencies and the UN have to negotiate with whoever controls the ground.
Yes, I mean, but I also agree absolutely with what Rosemary was saying, that I think with whoever controls the ground, but there's another aspect to this, which is about, you know, the UN is only as good as the sum of its parts, because there is actually, for all the civil war and all the disorder in Syria, there is still a government, and it controls some of the territory, how can you say that the UN should bypass a government and move in? You know, you just look at it in as it were, our own terms. If, say, somebody didn't like what was going on in the UK and decided that the UN should be invited in and come and deliver aid packages in some part of the UK, say Northern Ireland, I don't think we would like that. And you can say, well, the difference in Syria is that the government's writ doesn't run across the country, and that is true. But where the government's writ does run, I don't think it's got any choice. As Rosemary said, the choice is between some aid on the conditions that the government, an incumbent government, still in power, with power over some territory, or not delivering any aid at all. And I mean, it doesn't seem to me that there's much choice there.
There is an argument, though, isn't there, Rosemary, that, you know, the UN could have done more. And when I say the UN, I mean also, you know, the permanent members of the Security Council, from America to Russia.
This is the confusion often that people have, because not necessarily in certain parts of Asia does the UN enjoy a high reputation. And across the Middle East, you will find people who say it's simply the tool of America. But that has to do with the most powerful members in the Security Council. And there has, of course, in the Syria context, been this ongoing struggle between the Russians and the Americans about the appropriate way for the UN Security Council to behave. And as Mary's just said, the Russians had law on their side when they said, you do not topple governments at your behest. Syria has its own government, and just because it's at war with its people doesn't mean that you can determine that its remit is over. And in those, but then there is this sense that lingers on, especially, I would say, in the West, that the UN is a good body because it isn't any of the countries that are imperialist or behave in imperialist ways. But nonetheless, it depends on their money and it is made up of states.
We're going to take a short break there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Return after this.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page large format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Mo Dzhevsky and Rosemary Hollis. We're going to talk about Brexit in a moment. But first, still on the subject of Europe, Turkey seems to have missed an EU deadline that would have allowed its citizens visa-free travel through most of Europe. Not Britain, though. EU leaders had earlier promised that Turks could have access to Europe's 26-country border-free travel zone as part of a hotly disputed deal on migration. However, the deal was conditional on Turkey meeting 72 conditions on border security and fundamental rights. And earlier today, the European Commission announced that Turkey has still failed to meet some of those conditions. Rosemary Hollis, I mean, this was a bit of a dark deal in the first place, wasn't
it? But it's not over. It would appear that this was a deadline set when there was this rush to convince European publics that the EU and Germany, more especially, were in charge of the situation and could control the flow of migrants, and there wouldn't be any more overrunning of Europe with just this endless flow from sub-Saharan Africa through the Middle East, from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, and indeed beyond further east. And you, as you rightly point out, it didn't sound like the most respectable of deals, and it did look like it was stitched together rather hurriedly. And unfortunately, the Brexiters have made great play of the fact that the Turks represent the biggest flow of migrants in the direction of Britain if we stay in the European Union. But this is to misrepresent what the deal was about and what is still on the table. This was for Turkish citizens to be able to travel freely, I think for up to 3 months, anyway, for a limited period of time, not to work, within the Schengen zone, as part of the deal. They've missed a deadline to achieve certain things in Turkey, conditions for refugees and so on. But this will come back again and could be precisely the sop that Europe ends up handing Turkey because they don't want them to have the right to work in Europe.
I'd like to be cynical twice over, because I think, as it were, the 72 conditions that were set at the outset, they may very well have been set rather in the expectation that at least the first deadline would not be met, would be impossible to meet. And so a deal that was becoming extremely unpopular across parts of Europe could be at least postponed. The second point of cynicism, I would say, is that an aspect of the postponement is all about the British referendum. Because good Turkey point. Made this peculiar entry into the British debate, quite wrongly, because the whole agreement with Germany and the rest of the EU was all about Schengen. It was nothing to do with the UK. Nonetheless, it made its entry into the British debate. I'm sure that it will come back. It'll come back in the European context after the 23rd of June.
Okay, let's talk about the European debate here in this country, because for those of you who thought that it was incredibly civilised and straightforward and lots of people going, oh yes, I understand your point, and oh maybe, what's your point? This is what happened a little earlier today on the Thames.
Has the second largest quota for fish in Europe after Denmark. You're a fraud, Nigel.
I just think it's a bunch of upper middle class rich people and multimillionaires laughing at people whose voices have never been heard for 40 years, who are here today screaming out, please listen to us.
That last voice there you heard was an upper middle class rich person called Nigel Farage. Basically, what happened here was Nigel Farage took a flotilla of boats up the Thames to protest against EU fishery laws. Bob Geldof, former pop star and aid campaigner, sent a rival flotilla up to hijack it. Rosemary Hollis, it's perhaps sort of the most entertainment we've had so far in this debate.
I'm very pleased this has happened, because the Remain campaign, which I support increasingly anxiously, by the way, because of all the claims about how wonderful it will be outside the European Union, and they seem to me implausible, but it was looking deadly. It was looking boring. It was all about stats. It was all about denying that they'd ever made this point, and about how they'd been misunderstood on that point. And you get Bob Geldof, loud music in the Thames, a shouting match with an appealing character, Nigel Farage, and all of a sudden things get much more interesting. And I could see people who didn't feel attracted to the Remain campaign feeling more attracted to somebody who's going to remind us that Nigel Farage only attended one of 43 meetings of the Fisheries Committee in the EU that he was supposed to represent the British on, and that he used loud music, and Farage tried to a water cannon, I gather, in retaliation.
It wasn't quite a water cannon, but yes, there was water was sort of
hosed.
Yeah, I think hosed more rather a cannon.
I have to say I agree with Rosemary that it sort of brought the campaign alive, at least for a few hours, and I sort of wish that it had happened much earlier in the campaign, because it might have galvanised a whole lot of other things. But of course, it came against, you know, when we see the television pictures, you know, this is one of the most spectacular backdrops you could have. You know, this was the stretch of the Thames between Tower Bridge and the Houses of Parliament, and you had this sort of mini standoff of two flotillas. I mean, I think Geldof's was rather smaller than Farage's, and Farage's was trawlers. There you had these two guys sort of yelling at each other across the Thames. I mean, it's brilliant, brilliant theatre. We should have had it before.
There has been a sort of a rather disappointing lack of stunts like this in the campaign so far. What should happen next? You know, if you were to have a, you know, propose a stunt for the Remain campaign, I mean, you know, any ideas, any thoughts? You're both looking quizzical. I think this is perhaps not the road to go down.
I should have thought of this before. I was rather hoping that people in the music industry actually would jump to the challenge. I don't know how they're feeling in the theatre community.
On that point, in fact, Mary, you know, does it, and very briefly, because we've got about 20 seconds left, does it actually help if celebrities get involved in this way? Because as Nigel Farage there said, he could, like, you know, say, oh, look, he's a millionaire pop star, yeah, and I've got ordinary fishermen with me.
Well, I think the Remain campaign, especially in the early stages, tried to wheel out loads and loads of people, from celebrities through industrialists through God knows who, to lend some degree of credibility to their campaign. And of course, it simply fuels the the argument that says this is the establishment. So I think it may have rebounded, but now maybe it'll come back.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. That was that for Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Gaia Lutz and Cy Villafuerte. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. My thanks to Mary and to Rosemary. We're back the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.